spend today talking about that. Founder of Islam, everybody probably already knows this, is Muhammad, founded in about 600 AD. In the notes it says that Islam is the world's fastest growing religion. That's not true. It's the fastest, probably the fastest growing organized religion in the West, in America and Europe. And that's for two reasons. Number one, Christianity's in decline. We're spoiled brats. We don't want the true God anymore. And then number two, Muslim immigration and the fact that they tend to have more kids than Westerners do. But at this particular point, Christianity is still the world's fastest growing religion when you go to, you factor in third world countries. China is going to have more Christians than any other country on the planet in just a decade or so. Whatever the average Christian looks like, he's not a white European. Okay, so. But whatever the case, now I do think that there's a extremely fast-growing non-organized religion, kind of the religion of the new tolerance, the religion of political correctness. It has some neo-pagan, neo-spirituality strands within it, New Age strands within it. Islam is not the world's fastest growing religion, but it is growing rapidly in the West. And I myself, you know, Islamic terrorism and all, I have a lot of colleagues who really believe Islam is the number one problem when it comes to life on the planet Earth, that Islam is the number one problem that we face. And I disagree with that. I think we should fear whoever's in the White House, the Supreme Court, and both houses of Congress much more than we should fear, you know, guys coming from other countries and attacking us. I think we just protect our borders and encourage our right to bear arms. If they want to bring it on, let them. I don't think they're going to be that big of a threat, but I do think we have political leaders who want the chaos, who want Americans to be afraid, who want Americans to beg the government to pat us down when we go from point A to point B. And so key to my fear is not so much Islamic extremism. My fear is you know, anybody can come across the border and our government doesn't seem to care. But when Phil Fernandez gets on a plane in Seattle that's going to land in California, they got to search everything that I've got, including my body. And it's like, I did 3 years in the Marine Corps, 10 years law enforcement, been an American citizen from the day I was born in 1960. And I got to be frisked. In the meantime, we've got a whole bunch of people sneaking across the border, and nobody even wants to kick them out. So I'm not even saying there's any easy solution to all that, but what I am saying is I think we need to recognize Islamic terrorism and the threat it presents, but I think we need to understand that, like our founding fathers, that our own rulers are much more, a much greater danger to us than people coming from other countries. But Islam makes up about 20% of the world's population. So you're talking about 1.4 billion people on the planet. That also lets you know that if just 10% of Muslims, or even just 5% of Muslims, are terrorists or want to become terrorists, that's an incredible number of people. But the numbers are probably higher than that. Now, Islam means submission, so Muslim means one who submits, and it's the whole idea of submitting to Allah. Their view of God. And the Quran is the Muslim holy book. We'll talk a little bit more about some of the other books that they respect and all and call holy books, but there's always a little catch to it. And we're going to see that to the Muslims too. Sometimes the Hadith holds almost their Muslim Islamic traditions, ancient traditions, holds as much weight as the Quran itself does. And by the way, you could go to Barnes & Noble and pick up the Penguin Classics, the Quran there. Just keep in mind, as bloody as it is in parts, it's been recognized that by people who can read Arabic, how watered down some of the passages are, so as not to push away Westerners. And the Hadith is like kind of a running commentary on some of the passages of the Quran. So the Quran will tell you to slay the infidel. The Hadith will tell you how to do it and give you specifics about cutting off hands and feet and things of that sort. The Hadith is the Quran. Yeah, and there's different ways. I generally spell the Quran like this. Sometimes you can also spell it like that. Some pronounce it the Quran, some of the Quran, you know. This is one of the problems when we put Muslims on suspected terrorists on no-fly lists. There's something like six different ways that you can, proper ways to spell Muhammad. So if a guy's got two or three names, you know, Muhammad, Jabir, whatever, and if you got five or six different ways you could spell them in English, I mean, the combinations there are so much that a guy's name, a particular guy, could be on the no-fly list with his name spelled four different ways. But if he comes in with one of the seven or eight other ways of spelling, and he might even be doing it to try to keep himself from getting caught, he just might spell it a different way. So it's all spelled phonetically, you know. And so that's why you can have two different ways to spell the Quran, six different ways to spell Muhammad. Now, Islamic faith and nationalism have led many Arab Muslims to despise Israel. Many Arabs want the Holy Land, Jerusalem. The Dome of the Rock is there. It's kind of one of the holiest places. You know, of course, Mecca, Saudi Arabia, is the place for Islam. But the Dome of the Rock in Jerusalem is approximately where the temple once was. So for the Jews to unilaterally build the temple would probably start World War III. And so that's why it's probably, for the Jews to rebuild the temple, scriptures teach that it will be rebuilt. It's probably going to take a peace treaty, and I would not be surprised, and it's going to have to be enforced probably by UN peacekeepers or whatever. So I would not be surprised if that's a 7-year peace treaty that the Antichrist will sign in the last days. Keep in mind, Muslims does not automatically equal Arabs. There are many, many, many Christian Arabs. But I was asked to speak at Nazareth Baptist School and Nazareth Baptist Church in Israel in 2005. I made an awful lot of Bible-believing Palestinian Christian friends, and they love the Lord. But they're very, very disappointed in the evangelical church. These are our brothers and sisters in the Lord. And the easy thing for the state of Israel to do is to just paint all Palestinians with a terrorist brush. So they'll treat Palestinian Christians as if they're possible terrorists, when it's very clear where they stand. And they're not allowed in the Israeli army. If you're not a veteran, the Israeli army, forget about getting any worthwhile job to take care of your family. And so a lot of the Palestinian Christians are, they have law degrees, but they can only practice law with other Palestinians. The Jew would never hire a Palestinian to defend them. And the Palestinians can't afford to pay them, so they also have another master's degree in another field, and that's where they make their money. And we've turned Bethlehem into a ghetto by wall building a wall and not allowing anybody to come in or go out. You got to go past armed guards with M16s. And so they can't do business with the outside. So it's kind of like the Jews being forced into a ghetto under the Nazis. So just keep that in mind that it's not, if you think of the Israeli problem as Jews good, Arabs bad, it's not that simple. It's really, really sad what's going on there. The Israeli state is not going to go in and kill Palestinian Christians, but they're not in a big rush to protect them. If they catch flak from the Muslims. So whatever the case, just pray for our Palestinian Christian brothers and sisters in the Holy Land. And we're losing Nazareth and we're losing Bethlehem because the Christians that have been there in Christian families since before 1948 are now moving out in droves because there's just no future for them, and the Muslims, believe me, are not going to maintain the Christian sites in Bethlehem or Nazareth. They kind of destroy any piece of history that isn't pro-Islam. The three types of Muslims are the Sunnis, which means the majority, and they follow the prophet's ways, then there's the Shia or the Shiites, they believe the Ayatollah in Iran, the Ayatollah speaks for God, so the difference between these two in this one regard, the Sunnis would be like Protestants who say, no, the Bible is the final authority, sola scriptura, and these guys believe that they've got a successor to Muhammad, he's the Ayatollah, and so they have great respect for the Quran, but the Ayatollah is the authoritative, infallible interpreter of the Quran, kind of like the Roman Catholicism and the Pope. So, and then you have the Sufis, who are Islamic mystics. I'd like to say that these guys, there's so few of these. The Shia and the Sunnis consider these guys heretics. Although they probably consider each other heretics as well, but the Sufis have so much in common with Hinduism, and we'll talk about why that may be the case. But I'd like to say these guys are too busy meditating to be any threat to anybody, but they have had a history of violence themselves. So, and even Hinduism, there's in India, you can get some Hindu brute squads that can do some damage. But those are the three branches of Islam. Brief history of Islam. It was founded by Muhammad. He was born 570 AD in Mecca, Arabia. His father died before he was born, obviously after he was conceived, but before he was born. And uh, You know, when we take a break, I could try to get a probably another copy of the notes there for you, you know. But his father died before he was born. His mother died when he was only 7, taken care of by a relative. He suffered from fits during his youth. They think he might have had epilepsy. Some would speculate maybe he was, you know, having some form of demon possession. For Muhammad, it could have worked either way there. But he hated the polytheism and the superstition of Mecca. He studied Judaism and Christianity and became a monotheist, believed in one personal God who created the world, and he called him Allah. And so he took the name of the moon god. Now there are a lot of Christian apologists who argue that Muslims worship the moon. That's just not being fair. That's a straw man argument. They believe Allah created the heavens and the earth. But when you're going to vastly change, try to convert people from one religion to your religion, you're going to have to use some word for God. So Muhammad chose to use the word for the moon god. But I think, you know, a straw man argument would be you interpret the beliefs of a person the way you want to and make their beliefs easier to refute than they actually are. We talked about that last week with our debates with Roman Catholics, that we often we tell them who they worship and who they don't worship when they don't define it that way. Now, when we get behind the definitions, we still might have a charge of some type of idolatry to bring against them, but you've got to understand a belief system in the terms of those who believe it. You can't just set up a straw man argument. If I build a cardboard cutout of Mike Tyson and beat it up, I don't have the right to go around telling people I beat up Mike Tyson, okay? And that's what we often do, is we act like we refuted a belief system and we just present a straw man of it. So now, how did he study Judaism and Christianity? Believe me, if you read the Quran, you will see very clearly that Muhammad never read the scriptures.
He was illiterate, right?
Some argue he was illiterate. I don't know how he would have written this stuff. Maybe he dictated it. I'm going to give them the benefit of the doubt and say, man, he was definitely brilliant. Whether he was literate or not, he was brilliant. But I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt and say he was literate. But it's kind of like, let's say that Washington State, the gospel had never been preached out here, or maybe it had been preached out here hundreds of years ago, but there's just no Christians out here anymore. So nobody knew what the gospel message was. But let's say this was a big trading state, and we lived on a trade route like Muhammad did. And so people from Christian lands, let's say New Jersey is a Christian state, and people there are real Christian. And let's say you're on a trade route, you open up a truck stop. And so you get a lot of truck drivers from all over the country, and some of them are coming from New Jersey. And you're learning about Christianity, not from theologians, not from preachers, but from truck drivers. Now, don't get me wrong, I love truck drivers. And you got some truck drivers that are probably better Christians than me. But you also got a lot of truck drivers that are very lonely and like to talk to human beings, and they will talk your ears off, even if they don't know what they're talking about. Those are the kinds of guys that Muhammad got his information about Christianity and Judaism from. Now you say, well, why would you say that? Okay, did anybody here, from their reading of the Bible, were you ever tempted to think that Miriam, the sister of Moses and Aaron, was one and the same as Mary, the mother of Jesus?
No.
Did you ever think the Tower of Babel, Noah's flood, all these things occurred in the same generation? So his knowledge of biblical times was all one generation. And so there's an awful lot of, and I don't think he was that ignorant, that dumb, but he was that ignorant, if you use the word ignorant the way it's defined. He was ignorant of certain facts. He was ignorant of Bible chronology. But I don't think it was because he was dumb. I think he was brilliant. But he just didn't have access to the scriptures. So I think he heard everything word of mouth about Christianity. Now here's something I ask my students at the high school that I teach at. Muhammad took a polytheistic people and he moved them to embrace the existence of one personal creator God. Okay? By moving people from polytheism, worship of many gods, to the worship of one creator God, which is so much closer of a concept to Christianity and Judaism than polytheism is, did he do Christian missionaries a favor?
No.
Okay, why not?
The way Islam was spread and the fact that it was preserved the way it was, as this is doctrine versus everything else, there's nothing but Allah, as opposed to spiritual chaos in a polytheistic subnational region, you now have a very monolithic culture that's going to resist anything that goes against their doctrine.
And I would add to that, you have a much more attractive belief system. Any missionary that's been out on the field witnessing the tribal peoples and all, or witnessing the Muslims, will tell you it's much easier to lead a polytheistic culture to Christ than a Muslim to Christ. Here's the way I explain it to my students. If I owed you $20, would you accept a Monopoly $20 bill as a payment? No. But if I gave you a really good counterfeit $20 bill that looked a lot more like the real thing, you might accept it. So basically what I'm saying is the closer a false religion is to Christianity without being true Christianity, sometimes the more dangerous it could be. And then the people, there are so many polytheists that are worshiping these quote-unquote lesser gods out of fear, and they want out. If somebody could show up from a missionary from a Baptist church with more spiritual power than the shaman, than the witch doctor, they're gonna sign up, and but they want out. And but it's when you get like, whether it's Islam, Mormonism, Jehovah's Witnesses, people who really think they've got the truth, they're the hardest people to reach. And so Muhammad did not do us a favor, yeah.
And they set it up that God is unknowable. I knew a guy who was in the Navy, was over there in Iran, and he's telling the story about the guy crashes a jet, and the only answer he's got to give is Allah's will. And so you put that against Christianity, where you need to learn and read the scriptures. If you're intellectually lazy, just take the one that says Allah's unknowable.
Yeah, and this is something that Islam promotes voluntarism. Now, not all, some Christians are voluntarists, like John Duns Scotus was a voluntarist, where God's will is arbitrary, and that whatever God's will, that's what makes it right or what makes it wrong. Well, the Muslims, that is their view of Allah. So with that, if a plane crashes, it was God's will. Now, what Christians would say, if a Christian is an essentialist, it says that, like essentialism, like me and most Christian scholars throughout the centuries, that God's will is not arbitrary. It only submits to God's good nature. So what God wills, He wills for good reasons. And what He allows for purposes of a greater good. There is no need of justification in Islam. See, now, by the way, when we say Allah is personal, we mean that Allah is, in the concept of Islam, is a personal being that has a will and a mind. Okay? But sometimes you will read books where they talk about Allah being impersonal. Okay? What they mean there is that Allah is a person, according to Islam, but He doesn't want to have a personal relationship with anybody. So it's kind of like if we got done the class, or if we got done, we're taking a break, and Blake asks a question or makes a comment, and I just look at him and say, "Dude, I'm on my break. I don't talk to you on my break." You know, you say, "Man, that guy is, you know, you have to call me a jerk." You could probably point and say, "Well, what do you mean he's a jerk? He's just so impersonal. He doesn't want to personally relate to us." So Allah is impersonal in that sense, but He is a person that has a will, that judges the wicked and things of that sort, okay? The problem is, we've been saying that the pantheistic God, the God of the force of Eastern religions, is impersonal. So that's why I wish that we would just use for the belief, pantheistic belief that God is just a force. We say He's a non-personal force. But there's a lot of equivocating that goes on with the word impersonal. And so anytime you see that with Islam, where God is impersonal, what they're talking about, they're not saying He's not a person. They're saying, your goal in Islam is just to avoid God's wrath. It's not to run to the loving arms of Allah. Allah uses His arms for different things than love. Okay? It's kind of like a father who spanks his children and never hugs them. You look at those arms, it only means one thing. You want to avoid them. And so just keep that in mind as you read in your textbook about Islam and other books on the topic. But Muhammad received his first vision at the age of 40. He received several visions and recorded them in the Quran. At first he thought he was demon-possessed when he was being visited by these presences, but then later he changed his mind. He became more familiar with these spirit entities and thought that, okay, no, this is from God, this is a good thing. I think he was right originally. I think he was demon-possessed. I really think that Islam and Mormonism, we underestimate them when we act like, you know, was Joseph Smith a con artist? You bet. Was he somewhat of a nut in some areas? Yeah. But I think the dude had real spirit entities that were appearing to him. And was that
history and doctrine-wise, Islam and Mormonism are practically the same thing.
There's a lot of similarities, which is really crazy because one is so polytheistic and the other is so monotheistic.
But if you look at their afterlife, Mormons believe that you can become a god, but becoming a god or whatever in Mormonism means have essentially endless sex.
Yeah, and
the same thing as Islam
and paradise. And the thing is, too, with Mormonism, people think that there's no... that polygamy has been done away with, and it really hasn't, because you've got to understand that, okay, you look at the Christian concept of marriage. Mormonism, to understand the Mormon doctrine of marriage, it's eternal marriage. You get married in a temple. Okay? So, a Mormon male can get married to a lady in the temple, a Mormon lady in the temple, and that makes it an eternal marriage. If his wife dies, he's allowed to remarry in the temple, and that becomes another eternal marriage. If he has five wives and they all die, he can marry a sixth wife in the temple, and if he married them all in the temple, he'll have six wives in his eternal marriages. If a Mormon lady marries a Mormon guy in the temple, she's his eternal wife. But if he dies, she's allowed to remarry in Mormonism, but not in the temple. So even Mormons alive today, though they don't allow polygamy, only offshoots of Mormonism do, it is possible for a guy to be the god of his own planet and have six or seven. In fact, one of the Mormon... one of the Mormon apostles, and I'm talking about a Mormon alive today, the guy's like 90 years old and he's been married four or five times. And I don't know why all these his wives are dying one after another. He married his latest wife, looks like she's like 16 years old, she's probably not, but whatever the case, so you know, as our laws get more lax, they might bring that back and maybe grandfather in the ones who are already married. Keep that monogamous. There are all Mormon offshoots that where they believe that Wilford Woodruff, the Mormon apostle, that the Mormon prophet that said God told them to stop polygamy so Utah could get statehood, and they consider him a false prophet. And so you get all these polygamous offshoots of the Latter-day Saints, but they can make a pretty good case that they're truer to the teachings of Brigham Young and Joseph Smith than later Mormon prophets have been. But whatever the case, so there are a lot of similarities, as you mentioned, between Mormonism and Islam, yet the real glaring difference is Mormons are polytheistic, although they deny it, believe in many gods, and Mormon males can become gods someday. Whereas Muslims believe in only one God. Okay, so he received these visions. First he thought he was demon-possessed, but he changed his mind. And supposedly God told him in a vision that he was God's apostle. And so he started to proclaim his message and try to convince people to give up on the polytheism and superstitions of Mecca, but he was rejected at Mecca, so he had to flee to Medina. It's called a flight, the Hijra. He returned to Mecca and then conquered it militarily, and it was Muhammad's goal to unify the Arab tribes under Allah's rule. He died in 632 AD without picking his successor, and divisions arose. And that was what led to the first two branches of Islam. Okay, so we have any questions at this point? What we're going to be looking at next are the five pillars of Islam and the five articles of faith. The way I differentiate them is that, you know, pillar starts with a P, and just remember those are kind of the five practices that you have to do to be a serious Muslim, whereas the five articles of faith are more doctrines. But the five pillars of faith the first is the creed. Okay? You have to recite it in public to become a Muslim. There is no God but Allah, and Muhammad is his prophet. There's no God but Allah, and Muhammad is his prophet. Now, I just recited that in public. Does that make me a Muslim?
No.
And why not?
That's a good question.
Right. You've got to say it believing. They're, you know, they just say, okay, if you recite this in public, you become a Muslim. But what they're implying is you say that believing it, okay? It's just like, it's kind of like water baptism is supposed to be our, for the early church, it was the first public confession of Jesus as your Lord and Savior once you got saved. Nowadays, it's like, okay, good, you trusted Jesus for salvation, now we're going to give you a year-long catechism before we baptize you. By the way, you can make a good argument for either side of the issue, because we're baptizing people who are going to hell on a pretty regular basis in the evangelical church today, because nobody knows what they're supposed to believe. And we need to acknowledge, we need to see that a person really does understand the gospel message, all the essentials of it, which includes the bodily resurrection. When's the last time you heard somebody share the gospel message with the resurrection involved in it? And then they have to claim that they really believe it, but you don't know their heart. So if you baptize somebody and they turn out to be an apostate, you're in good company. What Philip baptized Simon the sorcerer. So, I mean, but whatever the case, this creed is kind of like that public confession that you acknowledge Allah as the only true God and Muhammad as the prophet. What were the, anybody know the two most famous, probably the two conversions seen by more people, at least in America, but probably even throughout the world than any other? Two public conversions to Islam.
Cassius Clay.
When Cassius Clay converted to Islam and changed his name to Muhammad Ali, he did that right after, I believe it was the rematch with Sonny Liston. And they usually say it in Arabic. They want you to say it in Arabic. So nobody knew what he was doing, but he was actually converting to Islam when he said it. Now, with Lew Alcindor, who became Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, I don't think he did his in public, and especially not public, like right after, I mean, he did it in public, but not like national TV right after a basketball game, not that I know of. But Mike Tyson was the other guy. I don't think he stuck with it, but he's getting interviewed after knocking some dude out, and he's speaking Arabic. I don't know Arabic, but I know when they're doing a creed, you know, I know what's going on, and the guy interviews like, yeah, whatever, but and asking a question about the fight, and I'm telling the guys that are all around me, you know, guys who like the fight game, like boxing, but not all of them are Christians, and I'm saying, he's converting to Islam. Tyson's converting to Islam, and they're like, yeah, whatever, they're doing the same thing to me that the announcer's doing to him, so, by the way, Muhammad Ali, that's, the whole black Muslim movement is considered a heresy by traditional Muslims. They're not considered true Muslims. And one of the big tenets of Islam is that Allah cannot become a man. Yet, the black Muslim movement, Elijah Muhammad, is treated as if he's divine. And Louis Farrakhan treats himself as divine. But after the death of Elijah Muhammad, his son Wallace Dean Muhammad broke from the Nation of Islam and started moving the black Muslim movement closer to traditional Islam. And Muhammad Ali, and they stopped, they toned down the rhetoric about calling whites devils and stuff like that. And Muhammad Ali sided with, and this was the direction that Malcolm X was moving, to a kinder, gentler form of the black Muslim movement. And so Muhammad Ali followed him. Lew Alcindor, who converted to Islam, became Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. He's also in the more mellow form of the movement, which I would not be surprised if they're now being embraced by Islam in general.
Are they still preaching that white people are science experiment gone wrong?
I don't think so. And Farrakhan, big time.
Well,
Farrakhan even believes that Elijah Muhammad visited him in a spaceship.
Yeah, he thinks Jews are aliens.
The Nation of Islam is way out there. It's probably, the Nation of Islam is actually, I would argue, it's probably more paranormal, new age, and racist than it really is Islamic. But whatever the case, and they keep going around, you know, saying that Christianity is the white man's religion. I guess you people haven't taken a close look at Christianity the last 50 years, because if you put all the Christians in the world together and then took a picture from, you know, from a real high altitude, there'd be white dots out there, but probably most of the Christians on, you know, I don't know for sure, but I would think probably most Christians on planet Earth are either first or second generation Christians. So when Dawkins says, well, you're obviously a Christian, you were born in a Christian country. Most Christians on the planet today were not born in Christian countries. You gotta read up, study the world of religions in the 21st century there, Dawkins. So he returned. Oh, so we were talking on the pillars of faith. So the first is the creed, okay? That's recited in public to become a Muslim. And second is prayer. Pray five times a day facing Mecca. We're seeing this more and more. You know, this, I'm telling you, America is so godless. Judgment is coming. And I hate to sound pessimistic, but if you're not preaching that judgment is coming to America unless America repents, I'm baffled. I'm wondering what Bible are you reading? But Christians are constantly being told, keep your mouth shut. You got freedom of religion, but that's inside your church building and that's inside your home. But we're having second thoughts about your home because we're convinced teaching children about the Christian God is child abuse. Okay? So that's the way Christians are being treated. Muslims now, a lot of workplaces, they're coming up with local ordinances that if you hire a Muslim guy and he wants to take five breaks for his prayers to Mecca, you can't stop him. Okay? And some bosses are getting in trouble for telling a guy, you can't keep taking these breaks for prayer, you gotta do your job. Everything's gotta, sometimes the guy's part of a team, and he's the only Muslim. When he takes his shuts down five times a day for prayer, sometimes the whole operation shuts down until he can come back. And now we got politicians saying that's okay. And then they're saying, hey, well, it's okay if Muslims want to have Sharia law. That should be the religious freedom. No. This is the kind, you want to come here, you've got to assimilate. You can rejoice in your culture. Keep your a lot of your cultural type things, but the law of the land is the Constitution, not the Quran. And but I'm telling you, America's got judgment coming big time. And you know, President of the United States, he takes big Christian holy days like Easter and Christmas to talk about all the horrible things that Christians did to non-Christians throughout the ages. And then he can't call Islamic terrorism Islamic. So they pray five times a day. They get on their prayer rugs. They get down, you know, faces down. That's the kind of relationship you have with Allah. Now, by the way, I think we Christians need to get on our faces a lot more. As Paul does say, work out your salvation with fear and trembling. However, you know, we still do need to fear and tremble in the presence of our God. At the same time, He does love us. And he will take us to the woodshed, and he will whoop his people, but he does that because he loves us. Love is mentioned numerous times in the Quran, but I don't know what they mean by it. It's almost always in the context of ordering the killing of infidels. But if they convert, don't kill them. For Allah is loving and merciful. Well, love like that, who needs hate? Number three is almsgiving. They have to give 1/40 of their income to Islamic causes or charity. I have to admit, the Black Muslim movement in the inner city, they do a lot of good with this 1/40 income. I can remember my dad would take me and my brother Mark when Muhammad Ali started making his comeback. We were Ali fans. So they take us to this theater in the heart of North. At the time, it was the most violent city in the country, late 60s, early 70s. But we were not only the only three, we seated about 5,000 people. We watched all these fights close circuit. But not only were we the only three white guys there, there was something else about the way they looked at us. It was almost like, it wasn't just they looked at us like you didn't belong here. It was like, we can't believe you're here. So a few years before my dad died, when he was in his 80s, he was watching television, his hands behind his head, and I said, Dad, what was the name of that theater in Newark we used to go to watch all these fights in? My dad said, it was called the Mosque Theater, M-O-S-Q-U-E. And I looked at my brother-in-law, Tom, and he just looked at me and said, your father was a very naive man, you know. So I don't know if that's the way it is, if the most of that money goes to build big buildings or pay their imams, that's kind of their preachers, their rabbis, or if they're taking care of people like the Black Muslim movement was doing in the inner cities. Another good thing the Black Muslim movement was doing in America was encouraging guys to get off government assistance, start your own businesses. Whereas the Middle Eastern Muslims that are coming here, a lot of them are milking the system because we're the infidels. So if they get as many freebies from us as possible, I have a relative who worked in the ward at a hospital in New Jersey that took care of, mothers giving birth to babies. And they had some Arab Muslim doctors. And so they were having wealthy Arab families who fly in a week before to a week after. And they were using hospital rooms as if it was a hotel for the whole family. Often they would demand that the door be removed and they'd put a curtain up. And they would have their babies, and the babies would be U.S. citizens, and probably, I don't know if they received, like, you know, welfare or whatever when they go back to Saudi Arabia or wherever they're coming from. But they also, they weren't paying for the birth of the baby. That was paid for by U.S. taxpayers' money. And then, but they would give big tips because they didn't view it as taking a handout and stuff. And if you turned down a tip, you got in trouble. So they had a big jar with tip money. And, you know, my relatives said that it just kept adding up, but nobody wanted to touch it, you know? And then you get a complaint if you made eye contact with one of the Arab males or one of the Muslim males. But believe me, the Founding Fathers, forget about illegal immigration. The Founding Fathers, we totally oppose that. You got to protect your borders. But when it comes to legal immigration, the founding fathers would say, you can come here if we trust you and believe that you're here to assimilate with us and submit yourself to our culture and our laws. But if you're here to annihilate, not to assimilate, go back home. We don't want you. And only a foolish people would ever allow that. Now, I wouldn't say only a foolish government would allow people to come here and want to annihilate us. A very smart government that wants to enslave its people and wants to have a police state, yeah, they're going to allow a lot of enemies in there. Because then eventually we'll beg the government. You know, disarm the law-abiding citizens, bring in people who hate America in our midst, and then eventually we'll be begging the government to... there's only two ways to keep order in a society. The American model of limited government, where nobody breaks into your house because they know they'll probably get shot, and the people are spiritually mature enough to police themselves. And then there's the Soviet Union model, where you keep order because tanks roll down the street every 5 minutes, so even the thugs are afraid of tanks. That's why America is, quote-unquote, so violent. We've left this, but we haven't arrived here yet. When we arrive here, we'll be safe. Problem is, we won't be free. And Saddam's give 1/40th of your income donated to charity or to Islamic causes. Number four is fasting. They fast from sunrise to sunset. During their holiest month, holy month, Ramadan. And then there's the pilgrimage. That once in a lifetime, they go to Mecca. So once in a lifetime, they travel to Mecca. They go to the mosque there and kiss the black stone. The black stone is probably a meteorite or something that fell out of heaven, but I don't know exactly what it is. I remember I used to get Ring Magazine to keep up with the boxing news. And Muhammad Ali, they had a picture of him kissing the black stone. So that's the, those are the five pillars of faith for the Muslims. We'll take a little break and look at five articles.